to Acoustic Music Talk, where we explore the art of acoustic music and musicians, with your host, Brad Apple.
Hello, folks, and welcome to another edition of the podcast of Acoustic Music Talk. I'm your host, Brad Apple, and I'm delighted that you could join me today. We've got a great show coming up today. Back in 1982, I was 7 years old, and it was either that year or not very long after that, that I first heard a record called Here Today. Well, on that record was David Grisman, Vince Gill, Herb Peterson, Jim Buchanan, and Emery Gordy Jr. And I really loved that record, and always wish they had made another one instead of just the one. But today we got one of those gentlemen on the show with us, and that is Mr. Herb Peterson. And I've listened to Herb, well, since then, since that time in my life. And from there, I guess I next was aware of him in the Desert Rose Band, a great country band, California country that he had with Chris Hillman and John Jorgensen and J.D. Manus and a bunch of those guys. And then, of course, in the 90s, about mid-90s or so, he made a record, bluegrass record, with Larry Rice and Tony Rice, along with himself and Chris Hillman, called Out of the Woodwork, and they followed that up with two more records. So I've literally followed this fellow ever since I was a kid, basically, and I'm so delighted to have him on the show with us today. I was going to start by asking you about your beginnings in music, how you started to learn to play banjo and get into music like you did.
Well, probably in grammar school, I picked up the guitar a little bit. My mom had an old Stella guitar in the closet that I found, and she showed me a couple of chords, and then I ran into a buddy of mine in the fifth grade, Butch Waller, who is now a mandolin player with a group called High Country out here in California. He and I went to school together, grammar school, and we fell into that whole thing of Everly Brothers harmony and that kind of thing, and we kind of got started that way. And I didn't get into the banjo till I was around 16 or 17.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of a late bloomer with that.
Yeah, well, I just learned something. I didn't realize that you started banjo that late. Not that that's that late, but... Later
well,
than
well, there wasn't really anybody out here other than one group that we used to go listen to, the Redwood Canyon Ramblers, and they were a bunch of guys who were going to Cal Berkeley, and they were really into bluegrass and the real traditional stuff, and so that's how I kind of got hooked on it.
Okay.
And yeah, so.
And I know you met. You met some kind of integral people early on in your career, like Larry and Tony Rice and, of course, Chris Hillman. I guess maybe you were late teens, early 20s. I'm not sure exactly when you met up with them.
Well, actually, I didn't meet Chris till 1963 down at the in L.A. at the Troubadour. And he was in a bluegrass band, the Golden State Boys, with Rex Gosden. And I had a band from Berkeley, the Pine Valley Boys, and we hooked up, and we got great, even from that early point, you know, just learning about the music. And Chris was fortunate enough to be able to learn from Vern and Rex Gosden, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, we had a good relationship even back then. You know, we were still learning about the music, and we didn't see much out here in California. You know, there wasn't internet and, you know, all of the things that, you know, make it a lot easier to understand the music. So I basically got into it by needle drop, you know, the old way of learning how to play. I got my first dose of that on record with the country music album that Flatt & Scruggs did on Mercury.
Okay.
And that's what got me started on the banjo. And I just, you know, looked at my other career and I just thought, nope, this is what I want to do. So,
yeah. What was your other career, if I can ask?
Well, I was thinking about being an architect, you know, but that would have been a lot of schooling and all that. But the music bug got me, and, you know, I just fell in love with it, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did.
Thank you.
You've given us a lot of great music because of that.
Thank you. And then Tony and Larry, they were in a group called the Haphazards down here in L.A., and they were just young kids. They were like 13, 14 years old. And we all played at this bluegrass festival out in Pasadena that Bob Stane, S-T-A-N-E, had produced. And so there were a lot of groups, you know, that were around that played at that festival. Kentucky Colonels and the Haphazards and the Pine Valley Boys and I think David Lindley's band, the Mad Mountain Ramblers, they played out there this long weekend thing that we had going. And
wow.
Yeah, so that's when I first met Larry and Tony. Yeah, so years later, of course, you know, I run into Tony and also Larry at a festival up in Grass Valley, California. And Larry said to me, hey, you know, we should do a record. You know, okay.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to get with Chris. And so that all kind of fell together. And so that's where those records came from.
Yeah. And the first one was Out of the Woodwork, right?
Right. Correct.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was great. I loved all those records, actually. Probably if I had to pick a favorite one, the first one would be my absolute favorite record.
Yeah, you know, it's like the old term that Glenn Frey came up with the Eagles. He said, you know, you have your whole life to get ready for your first album, and you have 6 months to get ready for your second.
Yeah. Hey, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
But we had a great time, you know, sitting across from Tony and Larry, you know, in the recording studio and looking at what Tony was playing, which was Clarence's guitar that I had seen many years before, you know, when I was working on Clarence's record for his first solo album on Warner Brothers.
Okay.
And, you know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful time, you know.
Yeah.
And Tony really brought it to fruition with his ability, you know, and extending what Clarence would have done probably, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you know Clarence before working on that record with him, or was that kind of your first time being around him?
No, actually, when the Pine Valley Boys, we came down from the Bay Area, Berkeley, to L.A., we ran into the Colonels a few times at the Ash Grove, and we got to be friends. And it was a very small circle of people that were into bluegrass at that point. And so we would hang out with the Colonels. And we learned from them, and, you know, it was great. Billy Ray Latham, you know, taught me a lot of stuff about backup and, you know, who to listen to and all that. Because, you know, we were 18-year-old kids. We were just starting out, you know.
Right. And speaking of Billy Ray Latham, you were in a band with him, too, at Laurel Canyon Ramblers, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I dragged Billy back into the business.
Yeah.
He was kind of retired, and I just said, no, come on, you know, let's do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, that first album we did, you know, was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And,
well, kind of jumping back to your younger days, I know you also played with Vern and Ray, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rick Shubb was originally their banjo player. Actually, no, before Rick Shubb, let's see, what was his name? Luther Riley, I think was his name. He was the banjo player with Vernon Ray and the Carroll County Country Boys, and they had come out from Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And lived up in Stockton, California, and they would play in the Bay Area once in a while, and so I went and saw them, and God, I fell in love with their singing and just, you know, what they what they were, because it was the real deal, you know.
Right.
And so I went out to one of their rehearsals out at Rick Shub's place and listened to them and, you know, just thought that was just the greatest, you know. And so Rick was moving on to other stuff, and I got the job with them, and so that became, as opposed to a duet, it was more of a trio kind of stuff, you know. So that felt real good, you know.
Yeah. Did y'all make any records together? Is that collaboration?
No, we never did, but we played at the San Francisco State Folk Festival in 68, and that's on our Hooli Records.
Okay.
Somebody had taped us, and so I got a tape years later of the show that we did, and I had my wife Libby put it through Pro Tools, and we kind of cleaned it up and sent it to our Hooli, and they liked it, and they put it out. So,
oh, okay.
It's out there.
Awesome.
Folks. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I'm probably skipping around and glossing over some things because you've done so much stuff. It's hard. I was going to ask you too about the Dillards. How you came to be with them? Was that, I guess that was after Vernon Ray?
Yes, I was in Nashville with Vernon Ray, and Dean Webb called me, and they said that Douglas had left the group, and would I be interested in trying out? Basically, okay. And I said, well, I just got off the road with Lester Flatt, so, you know, sure, you know, that sounds good. And I was looking for a way to get back to California anyway. So
yeah,
Vernon Ray and I were playing the Ash Grove for 2 weeks. And back in those days, Ed Pearl, who owned the Ash Grove, he would book you for 2 weeks. So it was a great way to see people like Flatt and Scruggs or Bill Monroe, Muddy Waters, all these great, you know, roots kind of music, you know. So I told Dean, yeah, well, I'm coming out there next month. And he said, okay, great. Well, you know, come by and we'll play some tunes and see how it works. And so I did, and it worked out okay.
And you made how many records with the Dillards?
Two.
Two, okay. I know Copperfields was one of them.
Yeah, Wheat Straw Sweet was the first one.
Yeah.
And then Copperfields, and then I left the group because I was getting real busy with studio work in town. And then later on, Rodney asked me to do an album with them, producing it, and it's called Let It Fly.
Okay.
And we did that in Branson, Missouri. This is many years ago. And tell you, Rodney and I are maybe doing a project together to kind of bookend the Wheat Straw Sweet period, and, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that'll be awesome.
Yeah, that might be fun. So
yeah.
We'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
But,
well, didn't I hear you say one time, I think in another interview, that your work with the Dillards and like with the harmonies and how you worked those out and everything, did that... That kind of led you into studio work, didn't it? Maybe like Linda Ronstadt heard some of what you'd done.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, Linda heard what we had done, and she called me to come in and sing on her early stuff. And so that kind of, you know, it's word of mouth, you know.
Right.
And then Emmy Lou came into the picture with Linda, and then Linda recommended me to work with her, and on and on, you know, it just kind of goes like that.
So you've played probably literally on hundreds, if not thousands, of records. I know I've seen you on a lot myself in my collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess the studio musician thing, that you did that for a while, and then I know you've also done touring with other people, like you were in John Denver's band for a while too, right?
Yes, correct. I was called to record with John on an album, and Milt Oaken, who is John's producer, he suggested that he bring the studio band out on the road to promote the new record that we did. And So it was people like James Burton and Hal Blaine and Emery Gordy and Glenn D. Harden. So, you know, a lot of the studio guys that were doing more country type stuff here in L.A. at that time.
Yeah.
And that worked out really well. We had a great time with John. He treated us really well, and everybody got along great. And it was good music, you know.
Oh, yes. So, how long were you with John?
From 77 to 81, I think.
Okay. Yeah,
somewhere in there.
All right. So about 4 years, give or take?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, also somewhere in there, in the late 70s, I guess, you had a couple of solo records also.
I did.
I'm thinking of Southwest and Sandman as the two different ones there. How did this come about happening?
Well, I was working with Johnny Rivers, recording with him and a little bit of touring, and he thought that it would be a good idea for me to do a solo record. So he hooked me up with Epic, which was out here in L.A. at the time, and Epic Records. And so I took some demos that we had done over to him, Greg Geller, who was the A&R guy at the time. And he listened to it, and he liked what he heard. So he said, well, let's do some more stuff. So I had Mike Post producing me. And so it got real interesting. There were some things that I wish I had a little more control over, but basically it worked out okay, you know, for what it was.
Yeah. And you had a lot of great guests on your records too. I remember Josh Graves was on Dobro on some things.
And, and I called Josh and I said, listen, I'm gonna, you know, I got a label deal and I want you to play some Dobro, you know, out here. And he came out. It was so great, you know. He stayed at the house, and he hadn't been out to California since Lester Earl days, you know, and so he really enjoyed himself.
Yeah.
And it was great to have Uncle on there, you know, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And then you had, I just went blank, the Little Feet guy, the slide guitar.
Oh, Lowell George.
Lowell George, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He played some slide stuff on it. You know, I had a lot of different people, and I had a lot of favors, people that I had worked with over the years. I had Polly and Linda and Andy sing on one thing, and just part of the family thing, you know.
Yeah. I was going to tell you, your version of If I Lose is one of the coolest I've ever heard. Heard that song done, you know, with Lowell on the slide, electric slide.
Yeah.
That was really...
Well, when I came up with that, you know, Mike Post, my producer, he just said, God, where did that come from? I said, buddy, that's the Stanley Brothers right there, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't really know much about them, and so I told him, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that was an awesome twist on that song.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to move forward in time a little bit here and ask you about what I consider a seminal bluegrass record, especially with you guys out in the West there. And I'm going to want to talk about the Here Today record that you did with David Grisman and company.
Sure. Uh-huh.
How did that happen there, as far as that record coming together?
Well, you know, it was one of those things where David and I had been doing some things together, recording, and he just said, you know, we should do a bluegrass band thing, and who should we get, and all of that, you know. And so it just kind of came together with just a lot of phone calls back and forth, you know, who would be the perfect one to do this or that, and you know, it just kind of came together pretty quickly. And that was like 1984, I think. And we had Emery Gordy on bass, on acoustic bass, which he wasn't really used to, but he got it, you know. He did a good job. And we had Vince Gill on guitar and Jimmy Buchanan on fiddle, and David and me, and yeah, that was kind of it.
Yeah. Well, that's a great record. I've always considered that a really awesome bluegrass record.
Oh, thank you.
One that everybody should listen to. Did you guys ever intend to tour any, or was it more or less just a recording band type of deal?
We did a recording, and then we did a few shows together, and because everybody's schedules were so conflicted, you know, David had his quintet stuff that he had to do, and I think Jimmy was still working with Jim and Jesse on some stuff, he was working with it was like a triple fiddle thing that he was doing. Mel Tillis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was working with Mel, I think. And so, you know, all the fiddle parts had to be perfect and all that. So he was busy with that.
Yeah.
And, but it was one of those things that, you know, it was just a great reunion with all those guys, and we had a good time.
Yeah, you know, speaking of reunion, I've always thought you guys ought to do another record. I know it'd be like an act of Congress to get everybody together again, probably. But
I know it would.
I've always wanted to put the bug in David Grisman's ear, like you guys should do it. You know.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's really up to him because it came out on acoustic disc, I think,
and
that's his label.
Yeah. Well, and then a little bit after that, your solo record "Lonesome Feeling" on Sugar Hill Records came out, which is another great record that I really love listening to.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun. Barry Poss, who was head of Sugar Hill, we had just done Chris Hillman's solo record, and Barry said, "Well, you know, are you thinking about doing something like that?" And I can't remember exactly who said what first, but, you know, it ended up that we did that record. And a lot of tunes that I really enjoyed singing and, you know, had guest artists coming in and playing on it, and, you know.
Yeah. And your version of "Lonesome Feeling," in my opinion, is the best one ever.
Oh, thank you. You know what? Sonny said the same thing. He liked the version a lot, which meant a lot to me.
You bet. Know? Yeah. Talking about Sonny Osborne?
Yeah,
your vocals, and then J.D. Manus's still is also just incredible.
And Bob Warford on Pull String.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So.
And then, I guess it was around 84 or so, you guys did, you and some more like David Grisman, and did a record with Dan Fogelberg, "The High Country Snows."
Yeah. That came about, Dan had heard, I guess, "Here Today," and he liked it. And I got a call from, I don't know if it was Peter Asher or somebody, regarding Dan. He wanted to do a bluegrass record, and maybe it was Chris Hillman that put it together with Dan and me. And anyway, it ended up me going to Nashville and recording with Dan and, let's see, Jerry Douglas, Emery Gordy on bass, Russ Kunkel on drums. Let's see, Doc Watson was on guitar on a couple of things, and Grisman, of course, on mandolin, and Buchanan on fiddle. So there we did a bunch of shows to promote the album, and then after that was over, John Jorgensen, we had put together Chris and John and myself and Bill Bryson to open for Dan for the High Country Snows tour, and that's what got the idea to put the Desert Rose Band together.
Yeah, that was my next question, is about Desert Rose.
Right. And so that happened right after the Fogelberg tour in 84, and we started Desert Rose in 85, and John was the one who came up with the idea, well, let's plug this in and see what happens with, you know, steel and drums and, you know, electric guitar.
Yeah.
And so that's how that happened. And I really credit John for doing, you know, the the bulwark of putting it together, because Chris really confided in me, said, yeah, I really don't want to do another band, but, you know, geez, this sounds so good, and
yeah,
let's give this a shot and see what happens, you know.
And you guys ended up making about 5 records together as Desert Rose Band, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Out of those records, what would be your favorite Desert Rose Band record?
I think the first one is my favorite.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
it
hard
just
to
has
beat that.
A lot of heart, and it, you know, we weren't being pushed by the label to get something out in 6 months and all of that. You know,
right.
I just thought the first one had a lot of soul to it.
Yeah, it's hard to beat that material too, like Love Reunited, yeah. And One Step Forward.
I know. Yeah. Well, you said it. Love Reunited. That's one of my favorite tunes on that album. You know.
Yeah. Would that be one of your favorite Desert Rose tunes? I had that down too. Your favorite Desert Rose Band song?
Yes, sir. It would be.
Yeah. Okay. So was that kind of what happened as the Desert Rose Band went along? Because I know I read one interview. Chris Hillman said he was really disappointed in the True Love record. That, you know, I think the record company had kind of pushed y'all to try some different sounds when it came to the True Love album.
Yeah, maybe so. You know, I don't kind of reflect on that stuff all that much. It's just another project for me.
Yeah.
But I don't mean that in a derogatory way. But once something is recorded, I kind of move on. You know, I don't want to dwell on, well, should we have done this or that? You know, there's always that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's a point in time where you have to record a certain amount of tunes, and we had those and we recorded them, and then I'm not one of those guys who you know plays all those albums, you know, year after year listening to what I could have done or could have changed or anything like that.
Well, that's fair enough. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's it's funny. Ricky Skaggs told me one time, he said, when the Beatles came on TV, you know, when he was home in, I guess, Kentucky, wherever he was living at the time, and they came on TV, and his dad was sitting there, and Ricky said, oh, he was so excited. He said, Dad, what'd you think of that? And I think his father said, son, that ain't the Stanley Brothers, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
So you know where that goes, you know.
Yeah. That sounds like my grandpa. He was kind of that way too. He had
sure.
Fit in a certain mold or he wasn't too much for it.
No, that's right.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
So I guess the country music scene started to change in the 90s, and then the Desert Rose kind of, I guess you guys just kind of mutually decided to disband that. And
well, we had been on the road for like 8 years, you know, which is a long time for any kind of band.
Yeah.
And Chris wanted to move on, and, you know, he had young kids that he wanted to spend more time with. So we kind of disbanded it, and, you know, I guess maybe 3 or 4 months later, Bill Bryson, the bass player, said to me, you know, hey, let's play some bluegrass. And I said, well, great. You know, what do you have in mind? And so we got Kenny Blackwell on mandolin and Gabe Witcher on fiddle and Billy Ray on guitar. And so we had, you know, a little bluegrass outfit, the Laurel Canyon Ramblers.
Yeah.
So that was fun to do. We had a great little run with that. And
right. And you guys did like 3 records with Sugar Hill too.
Yes.
And then of course, as time went on, I guess in the 90s and in the early 2000s, you and Chris have made a lot of great records together. And I'm thinking of the Bakersfield Bound record. And
yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
And then, we didn't have anybody shaking their finger at us, telling us what to record, you know, because we knew what we wanted to do, and we picked the tunes that really represented what we felt represented a California country music.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that was a great record.
Thank you.
And then you guys did Way Out West, too, in like the early 2000s, like 2003.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That sort of just an extension of the same thing, sort of maybe?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, because we enjoyed recording with each other, and we liked the same type of tunes from a period that meant a lot to us, you know, as kids.
Yeah.
Growing up and hearing Buck and Merle and Freddie Hart and Wynn Stewart, people like that, you know, so.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, move a little different direction here. I was wondering if you could talk some about your instruments. And, of course, a lot of people that listen to this will know that you play guitar also.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us about some of your banjos and guitars, maybe some of your favorite ones that you've got.
Well, this is a good story. I have a 1931 TB-11 banjo. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And it's got the original skin head on it, and I'm not lying to you.
Wow.
And I wouldn't take that off for anything, okay?
Yeah.
And it was originally a tenor, TB, tenor banjo. And I had a guy in Nashville make the five-string neck for it. And I think he works with Kel Croydon, and I can't think of his name, doggone it. And I'll kill myself for not remembering his name. but anyway, he made a wonderful neck, reproduction neck. It looked exactly like a four-string neck, only the five-string.
Yep.
And that's my favorite banjo. And I will never take it out of the house. You know, I'll take it in to record, and I used it on The Simpsons for many years.
Oh, okay.
Playing banjo. Yeah. And, gosh, I wish I remembered his name. But we were doing a festival in out in the desert, and Earl was out there with his group, and I brought it along because I wanted him to look at it, because I know that that was the first banjo he had when he played with Monroe. Okay, RB-11. Okay, so mine was 1931. And so we went out there, and I just waited for the right time, and I went around to his trailer, and I knocked on the door, and Glenn Duncan opened it, and he says, "Wow, what do you got there?" I said, "Well, I want to see the bar. I got something to show." And so Earl was sitting on the couch in the trailer, and he got up, and he came out, and I opened it up and showed him what it was, and he went, oh my gosh. Really? Oh, that's an 11. Yeah. You know, I played one of those when I was with Bill Monroe. I said, "No kidding."
Yeah.
You know? And everybody in the band is falling down because, you know, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, he wouldn't assume that anybody would know that, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I said, "Well, check it out." And so he played it. So he played a little bit of Fireball Mail and then something else, I can't. And so when he was done, I took the resonator off and had him sign the inside of the resonator.
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah. And so that's very precious to me. So
yeah.
I have that. I have, you know, a couple of different banjos that I use for different things. I have a Recording King that I used on a Tom Petty tour in 2016 with Mudcrutch. And I had to kind of plug it in, of course, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
But it worked really well. And let's see, what else? Well, I've got a 75 herringbone that I've used on a lot of recordings over the years with Emmy Lou and Linda and different people. Let's see.
That's the one with the elongated fingerboard, too, right?
Yeah, and the reason I did that was because in 75, I was doing a lot of studio dates where I was playing an E-flat, and for some reason, the fingerboard that was on there wasn't noting out right, and I tried moving the saddle and all kinds of different things, and then I thought, wait a second, Clarence did the same thing with a Gretsch fingerboard.
Mm-hmm.
On his 35 herringbone, and I said, maybe that scale is just a little bit different. So I found one, put it on there, and it worked perfectly.
Awesome.
So I could go from E flat to a G chord to whatever, and it noted out right. I was working on the Rockford Files, that TV show.
Yeah.
That Mike Post was the music director on. And so I was playing five-string banjo on that show and also guitar. So I needed something that really noted out perfectly or else, you know, I'd hear about it. So,
right.
So those are my two favorite instruments that I have right now. I have a 70 Tele that I have a pull string on that I use from time to time.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, it's a minimal collection. I have a D2812 that I used on the Lonesome Feeling album, and I've used it on different recordings where they need 12 string. And,
Yeah. Well, you mentioned some TV work. I was going to ask you about that, too. You've done a lot of soundtrack work through the years, too, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You said The Simpsons and Rockford Files. And...
Right. Hill Street Blues.
Okay. Did you do any of the banjo playing on Dukes of Hazzard or any of that stuff there?
Dukes. I was just going to say that. Yeah. McNeely did a lot of it, but I did some of it, too.
Okay.
And, Yeah,
well, that's awesome. I know usually all the chase scenes when their Duke boys are running from Roscoe, they start the banjo music.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah.
That's our cue.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about recording. Do you have any favorite microphones you like to record with your instruments and vocals?
You know, for the vocals, I usually use a U87. That seems to work really good. And what I like on a banjo... And I used this on Rodney's record, Rodney Dillard, the Let It Fly album that I produced. I had Steve Cooley, who was a great banjo player. He played through a RCA 44.
Oh, yes.
A big ribbon. You know.
Yeah.
And I love the sound that the banjo has on those. Because I like a banjo to have some depth to it. You know, I just don't like it real pingy and just all top end, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I like the U87. On guitar, an 87 and maybe a KM86.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, those are hard to beat. You know,
Yeah, they are. They really are.
Yeah. Well, you've worked in a lot of studios. I mean, countless recording studios. Do you have any favorite recording studios or ones that you really like?
You know, I really don't. It really depends on the engineer and how he has it set up. Because, you know, I've done a lot of stuff at United Western Studio 3 where the Beach Boys recorded and, you know, we did a lot of Johnny Rivers records there. Rockin' Pneumonia, that record, you know.
Okay.
Which was on the L.A. Reggae album we did back in 73. And that was in United Western 3. And that piano, the kickoff to Rockin' Pneumonia, that's Larry Nechtel playing that. And that's the same piano that Brian Wilson used on a lot of the Beach Boys records.
Oh, okay. Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's neat to know.
Yeah. And Leon Russell loved that record, that piano as well.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. You're from Berkeley, California originally, right?
Yes.
Did you ever record in 1750 Arch Street Studio?
No, I didn't, because that wasn't built when I was around at that point.
Okay.
I had already left town, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was curious. That's one a lot of bluegrass stuff come out of, especially with Grisman and Rice there.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. No, it's a great sounding studio. I never recorded in it. That I can remember. I may have, but I don't think I did.
Yeah. Well, I guess Grisman's got that equipment now of 1750 Arch.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah, from what I've read before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to ask you your thoughts on the current state of music with, like, the digital downloads killing the CD sales, and, you know, we're now kind of in a time where record companies are kind of becoming obsolete.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on, I know you've been through the glory days of, you know, when record companies were basically if you didn't have a record deal, you could forget, you know, doing anything in the music business. And
yeah,
I know you've seen a lot of changes in that way.
Yeah, I have. And I just, I kind of feel as obsolete as the rest of it, you know. you know, I get calls from time to time to come in and do some stuff. And Mark Fain, God bless him, is a bass player in Nashville.
Yeah.
Who works with, you know, he worked with Ricky for 17 years. We've got a little band with John Jorgensen called J2B2, mm-hmm. which is the John Jorgensen bluegrass band. And he'll, you know, he'll toss me a bone every once in a while, and I'll come in and sing or play banjo or whatever. It is different, you know. It's a whole different feel, you know, that you, when I remember going into Nashville with Vernon Ray, and we went into Harlan Howard's publishing company, and he was sitting there at his desk in his office behind the secretary, and we went in and sang live for Harlan Howard, and he really liked what he heard. I think we did a demo or something like that. But it's just all different now. You can't even get in the door anymore, you know.
Right.
It's a whole different way of looking at music, which is kind of sad to me.
Yeah.
Because the way I grew up, you know, it was a different thing. You either had the goods or you didn't, you know.
Right.
It's not something you can, you know, cut and paste like you can today, you know.
Yeah, that's for sure. It is different,
yep.
And people don't record a lot of times at the same time, which there's good and bad in that too, I guess. But
oh boy,
yeah,
I hate that. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, you were used to gathering up with all the guys in the studio and going down with a track all at once. There,
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah,
yeah. And what do you think about this part and this? You know, you interact with each other. You know, you talk about, you know, how, you know, who's going to take the first solo, what's it going to be, and, you know, it's all thinking about the song and the tune and how it goes, and, you know, what the lead singer is trying to promote in the song, and, you know, it's just all different now. I'm producing a guy, Mike Beck, who you might look up on Google. We did a record, and it's called The Saints, and it's Mark Fain on bass, myself on guitar, Steve Hinson on steel guitar, Pete DeCost on bass, on drums, I'm sorry, and Mark Fain on bass. And it's basically kind of California country sounding stuff.
Okay.
And I sent it to a friend of mine, Tony Brown, in Nashville, and he loved it. He said, God, you California guys, you've got that thing that I could never corral. I don't get that.
Yeah.
Which is a nice compliment. You know, that was nice to hear from him. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
So,
I tell you, I love the California country sound myself. It just, it's just a little different, and it just sounds better to me. I always like Desert Rose's music and just everything I've heard there.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Do you like digital recording, or did you prefer the old analog days?
Well, I like the analog, but, you know, digital is getting so much more sophisticated, it almost sounds like analog, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the longer, you know, you investigate a system of recording, the closer you're going to get to, you know, what it really sounds like, you know? And I think that's what's happening now with digital, but I prefer analog anyway.
Yeah, me too. I miss the old 2-inch machines rolling incessantly.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you what you're working on now. Are you planning any on anymore?
Well, right now, Chris and I are going to be going out. Hopefully, you know, with the pandemic going on.
Yeah.
Hopefully, September, October. Chris wrote a book about growing up in San Diego County down there and getting into the music business and all that. So we're going to be on the road promoting that September, October, hopefully.
Okay.
And so that's what we're working on right now.
Okay. Well, is the book going to come out around that time, I guess? Or?
I think it's coming out in May or June.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, great. Yeah. I'll look forward to reading that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny. He wrote this book about growing up in North County, which is what they call it down there. And he took it to the publisher and they said, well, this is great, but where's the music part? And he went, really? That's been written about so many times. And the guy said, well, not from your standpoint it happened.
Yeah.
So he went back and he added a few chapters about the music career. So it should be pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, good. It needs to have that in there, too, because that's just wrapped up in Chris, too. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'm really happy for him. This will be great.
Yeah. Are you and Chris going to make any more records? Have you talked about it? Or?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, we did the Bide My Time record with Tom Petty.
Uh-huh.
You know about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got that one.
And, yeah. And I don't know. We'll see. You know, you never know what's around the corner.
Yeah.
That's the wonderful thing and the curse about this business. You never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, do you still give banjo lessons, Herb?
Oh, once in a while, yeah. Somebody will come knock on my door. How do you do this or that, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You so still?
It's still fun.
Yeah. Do you still do them online? I know I was, at one time, I was your first student online.
I know, yeah, yeah. And then I had a bunch of guys. Well, Skype was kind of weird because there's that delay thing.
Yeah.
That you have to deal with, and I always thought that was a problem for you and me, mainly because of me. I guess I don't know, but maybe there's another system that smooths that out a little bit that I could look into. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I might have to get with you on it again someday. I still remember everything you taught me. Of course, banjo is not my main instrument. Basically, mandolin and guitar is. But
yeah, I know. You're a good one, too.
Well, thank you, Herb. I just had two more questions for you. I appreciate you hanging with me here.
Sure.
I was going to ask you what advice you would give some up-and-coming musicians, like somebody that's looking into music for a career, specifically you know, our kind of music, like bluegrass and country music.
Yeah. Well, boy, advice. That's you want it more than anything. It's like, you know, when you're asked, you know, what would you do if you weren't doing music? You know, and the answer that I heard from Tom Petty was, I didn't have any choice. It's what I do, you know, and if you believe in it strong enough, you're going to come through. If you have the talent, okay, that's the main thing. If you have the talent to go forward, stay with it, you know, do whatever you have to do, but don't involve a family or something like that, you know, just do it on your own. Then when you get settled into your career, then maybe look to have a relationship with somebody, because it's awful tough on people around you, you know.
Oh yeah.
If you don't have it nailed down as to what you want to do, and you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. You bet. Well, that's good advice. There's one other thing I just completely forgot. I didn't even talk to you about your songwriting, which is another great thing. I mean, you've written some classics. I mean, gosh, Old Train, Wait a Minute. Just to name a couple. Do you still write some songs?
Yeah, actually, I wrote a tune for the first time in about 15 years called Re-Election Blues. maybe I'll send you a little demo of it or something. You know.
Yeah. But,
yeah. Love it. It's just, you know, we're so caught up in, you know, who's right and who's wrong and who's, you know, what direction we should be going in and all that. And, you know, we're looking for guidance from, you know, people in the White House. And, you know, I don't want to get into that too heavy, but, you know, it's frustrating because, you know, a lot of people in this country don't know what to do now, you know. So, anyway, yeah, I've written a couple of things, and, you know, I'm just kind of at the tail end of that, and, you know, I'm glad that I've written a couple of things that people like, and, you know.
Well, you're too humble. it's just awesome, the stuff you've written and the things you've done, and gosh, I've just barely scratched the surface here with you, but I appreciate you so much talking to me and being on the show, and gosh, I look forward to seeing you again sometime. If you ever get close enough to me, I'll come out and see you.
Absolutely, buddy.
Folks, thank you so much again for listening. We hope you join us again next week. We'll have another great show lined up for you then. And if you can and want to support us, you can do so at www.paypal.me/acousticmusictalk. We would appreciate it if you are where you can help us and want to donate to the show and help us out a little bit. Until next week, I am your host, Brad Apple. Be safe.
Thank you for listening to Acoustic Music Talk. Join us again next week for another episode as we continue to explore the world of acoustic music.